All righty, if you could silence your cell phones at this time. Also, we ask that you please refrain from getting up and down during the speakers. We ask that you be quiet during the speakers. If you must, please leave quietly. If you smoke, we ask that you be away from the buildings. We also ask that you refrain from smoking e-cigarettes inside the building. Again, take that outside if you need to do it. And when you leave tonight, can you just pick up whatever you're holding on to right now and throw it in the garbage? All righty, I'm going to introduce our first speaker, and it's Clayton. And Clayton is from the Monday Night Men's Black Belt Group from South Tampa. They're serious.
Hi, my name is Clayton. I'm an alcoholic. I ran up here because I just realized I only have 10 minutes, not 15. My sobriety date is 5/28/2015. Well, my sobriety and clean date. This is all I had to prepare, so I'll read it real quick. Help things going. Growing up, I wanted to please everybody and be liked by everybody. In other words, I adapted my life. Adapted my life to yours. I wanted to be like you guys. In school, I hung out with the surfers, the skaters, the rappers, the boggy boys, rednecks. I adapted my life to you guys. I wanted to be like everybody else. And probably because I didn't know what I wanted to be. I didn't know who I was, and I thought you guys could help me figure that out. And when you guys didn't give me the credit, or you guys didn't give me the right answers, I drank and drugged, because that was my shortcut. That helped me build up my entitlements. It helped me to celebrate my success and failures in life, and that's what I did. Finally, I made a choice to stop for the first time to join the United States Navy. And so I had to be clean. And but I could drink a little bit, but I had to stay clean. And so I joined the Navy, and then something happened that I had to go through. And my sister, who was a year younger than I was, passed away in a car accident. And I was in the middle of boot camp, and I came home. And of course, they only allowed me 5 days, otherwise I'd be set back in training. So I had 5 days of drinking, and I didn't do any drugs, I smoked cigarettes and drank with my brother to get over the loss. Went back to boot camp and finished it out, and pretty much from then on, I was drunk every night, whether I was in training, whether I was on the ship. Being in the Navy, a sailor, it's kind of easy to get away with drinking. Eventually, that didn't do it for me anymore. I was trying to fill this void deep in my soul that just I felt like could never be filled. And so I resorted back to drugs. And this time it was for a different reason. It wasn't so that you could like me. It wasn't to have fun. It was to bring my sister back. You know, it's like now that my sister's gone, you know, she was a part of me. And I had to relearn how to live my life without my sister, which meant that I had to look at myself. And I didn't know who that was yet. And so my first sobriety date was 4/15/2005. That's when I first got sober. Couple years later, so the first year of sobriety was great. I was single, I was involved, I was a GSR for my group in the Panhandle. And I got involved really, really fast. And for being, you know, getting sober 4 months after you turned 21, it was a pretty crazy ride. In the Panhandle, there weren't that many people that were my age getting sober, or staying clean, rather. And so, I was hanging around with a lot of people who had a lot of time in sobriety. So that really helped. And then eventually I met my wife, and she was in the program as well, so that helped. And started another, you know, journey, you know, with relationship. And slowly but surely learning who I am. I went back to school, got jobs, got fired from jobs, you know, just living life the way it's supposed to be lived. Eventually, something happened. I stopped going to meetings while I was in architecture school. And I stopped talking to God less, or I started to talk to God less. And I was like going the wrong way. You know, to me, the steps, you know, step one, you're self-centered. Step 12, you're God-centered. And I really believe that the steps help you to become God-centered. And after the work, I worked the steps 4 times, but then afterwards, after not going through so many meetings and hearing, you know, reminding myself that I have this disease that it can take over, I just lost track. And, you know, after 10 years of sobriety, I thought I can get away with smoking pot with my brother. We've had a nice relationship together, but he's always been that, he's 10 years older than I am, and growing up, I always wanted to be like him, and I wanted him to like me as well. And the last time I visited him, I was so far deep into trying to figure out who I am that I started to rely on myself instead of my higher power. And instead of saying, no, I don't want to smoke, I said yes. And so that's why I have a new sobriety date. And it's been really rough to get my ego out of the way. And to realize that, you know, I didn't lose everything. You know, I had 10 years minus one day. You know, I haven't had a drink since I was 21. But this program is about rigorous honesty. And I tried to hide it for 5 months with the people that I meet with every month in my home group. It was, you know, I was just driving to work one day and I just started crying. I started crying because I was back to lying to myself. And I got tired of it. It's okay. I got tired of lying to myself over and over again, and perfect. And you know, I finally did something about it, and I became honest again, and I started working the program again. And you know, true story, how we got here today. I got 3 kids in the car. One of them, my daughter. 2 of them, her friends. We're taking her to karate. We're picking up another person from the program. And she gets in the car, and I'm about to back out. And I'm backing out, and I stop. Wait, is this a one-way street? And then I realized it was, and I backed out, and a black truck just drove by. And if I'd have kept backing out, it would have clipped us. And we probably wouldn't be here right now. But that's me recognizing that God is working in me, in my family. I mean, that was not a coincidence. That was God. And because I've worked this program, I'm able to recognize it now. To where when I first started this program, I wasn't able to recognize that. Bill Wilson in the 12 and 12 in the sixth step, he mentions his measuring stick. And the first time I read that, I didn't understand what it meant. But after working the steps so many times and working this program, I realized that when I first came in here, my thinking was insane. You know, I kept thinking the same thing but expecting different results. And as I went through the steps, that's my measuring stick. You know, I can measure the presence of God in my life, and that's what helps keep me sober. One last thing. So one of the best things that I've learned lately is you know, either I have to make an amend or I have to forgive. And I've always thought that you had to do that personally, like you had to make it known that, you know, you're forgiven or I'm sorry, you know. And it's not. I realize that I can forgive someone without saying it to them. And that really has helped me, because now I can become peace to myself and be peaceful to other people and to be able to help other people. If I'm mad at them and I just, you know, I'm mad because I have to build up the courage to say sorry to their face, you know, I'm destroying everyone around me and myself. And, you know, I've learned to forgive people without having to say it to their face, and it helps me to stay sane and sober and clean. Thanks for letting me share.
Thanks, Clayton. Alrighty. Chris, the other Chris, will read the tradition.
Yeah, I got you. Chris, alcoholic. All right. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. And Mikey's gonna do the chips.
My name is Mike. I'm an alcoholic. Here at 4D, we pass out chips, celebrate various months of sobriety. So if you hear your time, Paul, please come up and get a chip and a hug. First chip we have is 24 hours. Anybody celebrating 24 hours? New coming back. New way of life. No takers. And we have a chip celebrating 1 month. Anybody with 30 days? That's Sean, everybody. Everybody with 60 days? We'll take this. 90 days? Nice, buddy. That's Adam and Ronnie, everybody. We have a blue chip celebrating 6 months. Nice. That's Terry and Amanda. We have a purple chip for 9 months. Yes. That's Crystal, everybody. And anybody with a year, celebrating a year, anybody?
Yeah.
Nice. That's Sean, everybody. Anybody with multiple years? Nice. That's Gloria with 34 years. So, stay sober today. Give yourself and your high power hand.
I'd like to introduce our second speaker. Tamara's going to share with us, and she's from the Wellspring Recovery Group in Tampa. Come on up.
Hey, I'm Tamara. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Chris for asking me to speak tonight. My sponsor texted me today and said, you might be getting a call. There was a cancellation for a speaker. And when I got the call, I talked to her a little bit later, and I was like, it's not a big meeting, right? Because I've never been out here. And she's like, she just kind of laughed, and she said, oh, no. And I was like, and I know her laugh. I was like, oh, crap. But I'm really honored to be able to do service work for Alcoholics Anonymous. It saved my life. My sobriety date is September 13th, 2003. A little bit about myself is, I was raised in a family with three children. I'm the youngest of three. my father was Army, so really my history is just moving around a lot, but my parents were great people. My father was a very heavy drinker, growing up, but not alcoholic, which I did not understand for the longest time. It took me a few years in AA to kind of get the difference, but our book outlines it between, a social drinker and a problem drinker and a heavy drinker and an alcoholic. but to me, a non-alcoholic can put it down, if the situation arises where they really, really need to. And that was not the case in my life. Growing up, I did have a lot of fear and anxiety, and I was afraid of the dark all the time, which was one of the things. Like, I would literally pee my bed on purpose so I could go sleep with my parents because I just was scared to be there. And I got tortured a lot by my older brother and sister, just that sisterly, brotherly love. And at one point, my fear was so great that my parents took me to a psychologist, on base, to see if there was anything they could do. And he talked to me, and I just was not, so finally had this idea, and they came to the house with these Ghostbuster type cans and just kind of sprayed the house and said, we got rid of all the ghosts, we got rid of all the bad spirits. And I remember for the first time, like, this kind of sense of relief coming over me, like, everything's gonna be okay. And my sister leans over and she's like, there was just water in those tanks. And I was like, oh, and it's kind of funny because that story, I never told my mom about that. I told her what she knew about it. And just recently we were talking one time and she said, well, remember, you kind of eased up when they came and sprayed the house for ghosts. And I was like, do you know what Cassandra did, in school I did well. Academically, school was pretty easy for me. I was fine socially, though I didn't know it at the time. And sports came pretty easy to me too. I was 13 years old when I had my first drunk. Like I said, my father was a heavy drinker, but like, we'd go visit my grandparents. And all our social events with family, the norm was lots of food and lots of alcohol. And my grandfather would always give us like sips of beers or half a beer and be like, you need to drink a little bit of beer, it'll build your appetite. And then after dinner, he'd be like, you need to drink a little bit of beer, it'll help you digest your food. So that was kind of the norm. But I never, went and drank excessively. But at 13 years old, we went over to a friend's house. We were living in upstate New York at the time. And her parents were out of town. And I went over there, and her older sister was there, and her older sister was watching us. And we went and got into the liquor cabinet and drank a lot of red wine and a lot of vodka. And I don't remember much of the night, except lots of throwing up. And the next morning, my sister snuck me in the house and told my parents, kind of covered for me, that I was just sick. And I don't really, I remember it being a good time, Other than that, I don't recall ever thinking, oh, that was awful, with all the throwing up, I'll never do it again. I just remembered it being a good time. And that pretty much started my drinking career. Now, at 13, 14, 15, I wasn't drinking daily, but it was kind of the weekend thing for me. And I was sneaking out of the house, and with an older brother and sister, you know, I could kind of follow their lead and help. They would help cover for me and such. But it was, you know, and I could look back later and see the difference between how I drank at 14, 15 at high school parties and how my friends drank. I was the one, you know, they kind of got it or stopped and would go home and make it there. And I was always this bumbling mess, running from the cops, you know, hiding in bushes, being dragged home. And at 15, basically what happened is my sister, we moved from New York to Kansas. And I had a really hard time fitting in. And my drinking picked up. The only friends I really kind of met were people that drank. And my parents started to notice. And before this, it was like with the older brother and sister, that was more where their attention was. And at this point, they were out of the house and the attention was on me. And I'd come home and my dad worked for a he was retired from the Army and worked for a transportation system at the time. And he had a breathalyzer, so they would start breathalyzing me. And, you know, at 15, 16 years old, they were interfering with my drinking, and I was pretty much, how dare they? How dare they put a curfew on me? How dare they be upset that I was drinking? I mean, if I wasn't driving, I should be able to drink how I wanted. And basically, it was just a lot of turmoil. I spent a lot of time staying with friends instead of my parents. I put them through a lot. And at one point, with a real bad night, the next morning they were grounding me, all this stuff. And the next morning I got up to go to work, and I worked at like a little pharmacy, and I borrowed my dad's car to go to work. And I decided I had it. I was done with how, you know, they were trying to control me. And so I decided to, you know, we're living in Kansas, to drive to Florida, because my brother was living in Orlando. So I had $40 in my pocket. That was plenty, you know. And I drove on down, and my brother and his friend had to meet me in Atlanta because I couldn't stay awake and I had no money for gas. And, you know, they came in and met me and got me the rest of the way down there. And my dad came and got me after about a week. And he didn't really say much. And he made me go to Walt Disney World with him. And there's all these pictures of like me just mortified and horrified of waiting for, you know, the hammer to come down. And it was like this torture. But anyway, we got in the car and we're driving home. He's driving me home. And he said, are you pregnant? And that, you know, and I'm like, I'm 15 years old. Of course I'm not pregnant, you know. But he couldn't understand why I would do something so crazy as to drive across the country like that. And for me, you know, my alcoholism, you know, getting started, I just thought it was totally normal to just do whatever the heck you wanted to, you know, because I'm the most important thing and I should make the rules and I should do as I please. I managed to make it through high school. I was ahead from living in New York and being, you know, doing well academically, so I graduated a year early, otherwise I probably wouldn't have made it through. And I tried to do some community college, and I couldn't get through a class. You know, and I couldn't even drop a class most of the time. I just wouldn't show up, and I just couldn't be bothered to go. You know, it was just, you know, my drinking and abuse of other substances that was you know, that I wanted to do. Basically, through the next few years, I did a lot of geographical moves, and I also started. I started getting a few arrests here and there. Apparently, my intentions as a good person, you know, because with alcohol or non-alcohol, I'm not a bad person, you know. Even in my drinking, I wasn't a bad person, but during my disease, I did some pretty bad things. I did some not so nice things, but one of my things was I never intended to drink and drive. When I went out to drink that night, I was either gonna take a cab or drive or take a ride with you, as before Uber, you know, but anything besides, I wasn't gonna get behind the wheel, but usually it was, I was only gonna have two or three, so I'd be fine to drive home. Once I get, like, I think like every other alcoholic, or at least my story is, once I get a drop of liquor in me, and this is how I know I'm an alcoholic, I don't know where the night's gonna go to. I have no control over myself once I start drinking, and I am a big blackout drinker. So I had a lot of DUIs and some arrests for other substances. But my first AA meeting was actually at 18 years old, court ordered from one of the arrests. And I remember going and thinking, like, you know, these people are pretty nice and this, but at 18 years old, no part of me was thinking that I was, you know, one of you all. So I went basically through from 18 to 28 for the next 10 years, moving around and avoiding my probations that I couldn't finish. So, you know, I would be in Kansas getting arrested, and then I would go down to Orlando and get some arrest, and then I go to the Panhandle, you know, and get another one. And I had one, my boyfriend at the time was a correctional officer, and his father was some kind of police officer. They had like this whole police officer family, so they must have, I don't know, but the point of the story is I got arrested that night with him. And I didn't have a driver's license, but I have an identification on me, and I basically told them that I was somebody else. And they ran my fingerprints. I guess, nothing caught up with the fact of who I really was, and I said, I gave the false name of Tara Jonesborough from Georgia and all this. And I ended up the next day, somehow, they made some phone calls, and I got released under this false name. And at the time, there was a substance in the car that was, well, it was mine. There was a substance in the car. So part of the story is I get arrested, and the reason why I say substance is because I got a felony arrest. So to explain why I had a felony arrest was because of this. And so I'm going through felony probation under a false name. And I'm glad you all find this so funny. But, you know, and it's funny that we could laugh about it today. If I went into my work, my job today, and explained any of this, they'd be like, what the? But that was the craziness, the total lunacy, you know, madness of my life at the time. I mean, it was just insane, absolutely insane. And I was living always in, you know, unrest. And there was a couple times during that period, I knew what AA was, I knew where it was, and I would go back and I would try to hit some meetings and I would try to get sober. And I just, you know, I couldn't keep with it because I couldn't be honest. And at one point I was, when I was 25, I was living back in Kansas at the time, and I went to a meeting. And it was Thanksgiving, I remember too, because I'd rolled my car that night and walked away fine, but I had thrown the keys, so they couldn't give me a DUI, and the cops took me home. And I'm like, I can't do this anymore. And I got rid of everything in my house, and I called the AA hotline, and the next day I went to a meeting, and I was shaking, like, you know, and I was just like, I can't live like this anymore. And I was at that point where I didn't know how to live with or without drinking. And the people in the rooms, you know, scooped me right up and started taking me to meetings. I started working the steps with the sponsor. She was having me go to treatment meetings a lot. And I kept doing the 1-2-3 shuffle, in and out, in and out. And there was no way I could write a fourth step because I couldn't even tell my sponsor that I had no license, that I had multiple warrants out. You know, I mean, I couldn't, nobody knew anything about me. And I didn't know how to ask for help. You know, that whole self-reliance thing, I was so proud of it, you know. Like, I can take care of myself. I don't need anybody. But that almost killed me. So basically, I couldn't stay sober, and I finally end up going back to the Panhandle. My parents were living in the Panhandle at the time, and this was like a year or two later. So basically, I'm bouncing around in AA, I go back out, I'm a mess, it gets worse. The incomprehensible demoralization, you know. I don't like being alone, so I go to crowded bars. I'm only hanging out with people that are like as bad as me or so I say. You know, I mean, you know, roommates stealing toilet paper. You know what I mean? That's like the kind of people we are. Those are my friends. But you know, and I would go to bars, like sometimes if I wasn't going out with any of my drinking buddies, I'd go to bars by myself just because I didn't want to be alone. Like I didn't necessarily isolate. I wanted to be around people and I wanted to make friends, but I just could not connect with anybody. And I didn't know why. And so I ended up, things got, you know, a lot worse. It just was, I was just a mess. I couldn't keep a job. And so I ended up going back to live with my parents. And it kind of sketchy about it, but they were worried about me. I guess I was probably 27 at the time. They're kind of worried about me, you know, and so I went back there. And I said I needed to go to AA, and my dad's lending me his car again. They have no idea, I have no license. And you know, I got a job at a restaurant, and I'm just not staying sober. And I'm there for maybe a month and 1 week, and they go out of town to see my brother in Orlando. And again, I'm in the panhandle, like Destin, Fort Walton Beach area. And I go out one night to go work my job at the bar or at the restaurant in Destin, and then I go out drinking. It was September 11th, 2003, and you know, I kind of made the September 11th excuse of why I needed to get, you know, just totally wasted. And I went out that night after work by myself with my dad's car, and I don't remember much. You know, I mean, to this day, like the flashes of that night, I still remember those flashes pretty vividly, you know, but there was very little, you know, very few of them. And anyway, I went out, made a mess of the night, and wrecked my father's car, got a DUI, got arrested. And, you know, at the time, I remember the next day calling somebody to get my father's car, because I was like, before they get home, somebody's got to go pick up this car. And the car, I saw pictures of it, was mangled. And I didn't have a scratch on me. I had no idea I was even in an accident. But as I'm being arrested and booked and everything else, I hear them talking, the police officers, because now technology has kind of caught up a little bit. And they're just like, is that her? You know, they're pulling up these pictures and, you know, all the everything's lining up. They're connecting all the dots. They're like, Tara Jonesboro. I thought her name was Tamara. And so they're all laughing, and I'm just like, oh, you know. And the gig was up, you know, I was found out, and I got locked up. I, you know, I'm the first person in my family to ever have been arrested or put in jail like this. And I got locked up in the panhandle, and I couldn't get out. There was no bonds because I had all the warrants out in Orlando. At the time, it was warrants in Orlando and warrants in Kansas. So I was gonna have to be served all those warrants before I could get out of jail. And so I stayed in there. And I remember that first cut, what they do is it's a smaller jail, so they have like minimum and psych ward are the same place, and then you have like medium maximum are the same place. So I'm in minimum psych ward for the first 72 hours, and I'm like, somebody get me out of here, because like my bunkie keeps peeing the bed, the other one's screaming all night. I'm like, I need to be, you know, get me. And the other girls would come in that have been through the system, and they're like, oh, don't worry, you'll be moved over there. You can play cards and stuff and read and watch TV. And you know, that first 24 hours, I had a lot of stuff coming out of my body between caffeine, nicotine, you know, alcohol, and it was just kind of a blur. And after, you know, I was able to use the phone and make that phone call, and the guy asked to pick up the car told me that, and he's like, you know, your parents know everything. And I was like, oh my gosh. And I went back, and I was just feeling miserable, you know, just, I was just miserable. And I got down on my knees, and, you know, I knew who God was, but I was raised Catholic, and my God is not the God I have today. Nothing against Catholicism. I just didn't understand about that. I needed to have a relationship with a higher power. This, I just was raised with more of a punishing God, and there was hell and there was a devil. But I got down on my knees and I prayed. I must have heard it in meetings. And I just asked for help. And I remember having an overwhelming sense of relief come over me, just that everything was going to be okay. And I didn't get it. I don't know if like the obsession was removed or anything like that. I just knew that for the first time I felt some kind since the spraying of the Ghostbuster, you know, before that was ruined. I mean, that I had a feeling of relief come over me. And I hadn't had that in a very long time. And so basically I stayed in jail for 6 months. And if you want to tour the US, I do not recommend doing it through the jail system because it sucked. But you know, I spent a couple months in the panhandle, and then I got moved to Orlando. And when I got moved there, they were doing a pilot program there in one of the pods. and it was a treatment program. And you're in jail, you're doing everything in jail, except you're also going through treatment, and you have the COs and everything else, and it's like from, you know, 6 a.m. you start to like 9 o'clock at night, and you have to participate in everything and this and that, otherwise you're kicked right out. And I called my dad and I said, you know, they have this pilot program, this treatment program here. I think maybe I should see if I can do it. It'll probably look good to the judge. And he's like, oh yeah, I'm sure it'll look good to the judge. And, you know, and I don't even know why I'm like embarrassed to tell my father that I'm an alcoholic. Like, he doesn't have it figured out at this point. So I enter this pilot program, and they, you know, there's a lot of writing, a lot of step work. And it's 50 women. That's the max that can be in it at the time. And because of the situation, you know, I don't know how to say it nicely, but basically, you know, I've had, for me, any kind of, I would do anything you gave me to make me not have to be me. You know, I'm an alcoholic to the core, but it really didn't matter what you put in front of me. Is that going to make me not feel like this? I'll do it, you know? But the majority of the women that I was with were straight up crack addicts. And so when we would identify, I would identify as an alcoholic, and maybe one other person would identify as an alcoholic addict, and then 48 others would identify as a crack addict, basically. And a lot of these women were from the streets. And I got to hear a lot of stories about how bad it can get. And these women would, you know, the camaraderie, you know, like we talk, like the book, you know what I mean? The sinking ship. Where you're all friends and the camaraderie of recovery together, we would have that, and then like somebody's date would come up, they'd be going to court, they'd be getting released, and you know, I would hear their story, and they would say how they're changing everything, and they would make their recovery plan and how they weren't going to relapse and this and that, and I'd be like, yeah, this girl's got it, and they would leave, and I would see them back within a week, and I saw that over and over and over again. And I was in this particular, that particular treatment thing for 4 months. And it scared the crap out of me. You know, jail for me really, really sucked. And I just did not, I never wanted to go back there. I didn't, you know, not that anybody likes it. But I mean, it was just like a very awful, humiliating experience. But I also believe that it saved my life. I truly believe today that my higher power came down and put me there because I would not stop drinking on my own no matter what. That I had to be locked away from alcohol for a long enough period to get it out of my system, to get it out of my mind, to see something different, to be able to have a fighting chance to stay sober. So I ended up getting extradited to Kansas after Orlando and released at that point. And you know, when I was in jail, my mom came to see me once or twice when I was still in the panhandle, and my dad didn't come. And my mom said, I'm really choked up at this. I'm really close with my dad. I'm really close with both my parents today, but my mom said, your dad just can't see you in here like this. And I said, okay. And but my dad wrote me like all the time. We wrote letters back and forth, and he would write me like 10-page letters like every other day, just about anything. And you know, he came up to Kansas and he drove me back home and he said, you know, we're going to help you, but I want to let you know, my dad's from Greenpoint, Brooklyn. He's like, no joke, you know? And he's like, I just want to let you know that if you mess up one time, it's over. You know, this isn't like you have a second chance here. This is your one and only chance. And I said, okay. And I remember walking into my parents' house and looking at my mom and my mom looking scared. And it wasn't like she was scared for me. It was like she was scared of me. And it broke my heart, you know? And I just started doing the deal. I started going to a meeting every day. My dad drove me. And, you know, going through, I have two kids, so that doesn't bother me, just so you know. not at all. I don't even hear that. But I started going to a meeting every day, and, you know, I had to ask for help. And one of the things that happened is I was on house arrest, and I was allowed to go to one AA meeting a week. So I had to literally get a court order to allow me to go to an AA meeting every day. I mean, it was stuff like that in the beginning. I remember my first AA meeting in the panhandle after getting out of jail, and I knew I had to reach out, but I didn't really want to talk to anybody my first day, you know? So I kind of like sat in the back with a hat on. And of course, it's like not that big of a town. They know that I'm like a newcomer. So people just right away just kind of got me involved and got me doing stuff. And we'd race sailboats, and we'd go clean people's yards and clean houses or whatever. I would tutor people's kids. I mean, they, you know, people just gave me stuff to do and kept me busy. A woman came up, she's like, "Do you have a sponsor?" I said, "No." She's like, "I'm your sponsor." And she walked me through the steps. And I was so desperate that I was willing to do anything. And the thing is, when I went to meetings, I believe this program worked for other people, and I heard them share, but it wasn't going to work for me. You know, I would maybe stay sober, because I knew if I drank, I was going to die or go to prison, but I wasn't going to have, like, this life beyond my wildest dreams or anything like that. So I heard enough in meetings to have enough hope to keep coming back and not pick up. I was too scared to pick up, and I followed every suggestion. Like dating, I mean, and I sponsored a date, so when, you know, that whole thing about dating in the first year before you finish the steps, there wasn't even a question for me. I just was like, I was so scared of anybody, you know what I mean, that could interfere with my sobriety. I was just gung-ho to be there. And, you know, slowly my life began to change. My first year in sobriety was very, I keep using the word suck, sorry. I know it's like my vocabulary is so limited, but my first year in sobriety was very difficult. You know, some people talk about the pink cloud. I didn't really have that. I was just like clinging to just not drink and stay sober one day at a time. And it's not that I was obsessing over drinking, but I was fearful of it. And my sponsor at the time told me, that's a good fear to have. You should be scared to drink. Look what it did to your life. I had a lot of court dates I had to go to and probation to fulfill and fines to pay off. And 6 months out, you know, so I'm coming up on a year sober now. I have to fly back to another court date in Kansas, and it's about to wrap up. And I come and my attorney's like, well, he calls before my last time coming out. He's like, "You're going to have to do some time." And I'm like, "What?" I'm like, "Did you not tell them I've been sober, you know, almost a year now?" And apparently they didn't think that was that impressive with my record. And all these people in my home group, some of them, I had some of the old timers like write letters for me, letters of reference, I guess. And I brought those with me, and the prosecutor was trying to give me 5 years, and the minimum was 3 months. And the max was 5 years, so the prosecutor was gunning for 5 years. And the judge read the letters and, you know, listened to my attorney and listened to me, and he gave me the 90 days. And I remember when I went back there before time, when I knew I was gonna be locked up for some amount of time, I said to my sponsor, I'm like, "This is not fair. They don't realize what's going on. This isn't right." And she said to me, "You're right, it's not fair. You're standing up right now, not in a grave, you know? You're walking around here." And she's like, "Do you not think this is," she's like, "maybe this isn't about you. Maybe you're supposed to go and see what you can bring to the situation." And I was like, "Is she crazy?" But I did it. You know, I prayed a lot, and I did. I went in and said, "Okay, what can I bring to the situation?" And I was taught to pray on my knees morning and night, and sometimes more than that. But I went in there, and you know, I went straight in. And I remember my first night, we're in this room, and it's all open bunks. And I'm not really talking to anybody, and I got down on my knees to pray, and I thought somebody was gonna hit me in the head. Like, I kept thinking, like, somebody's gonna come behind me and smack me or something, so I'm sitting there with my eyes closed, and it got kind of quiet around me. And then a woman came up to me, and she, like, put her hand on my shoulder, and I jumped. And she's like, "Will you pray for my daughter?" And then another woman came up to me and said, "Would you pray for me?" And just, you know, it was just amazing. And so when I was in there, I didn't play the game of, you know, who's going to do what, or you know what I mean, just jailhouse games or whatever. I just spread the message that I was able to spread where I could, you know. I talked AA where I could. And when I was released and went back home, one other thing that I want to mention is my home group wrote me letters like crazy in jail. And if you've ever been to jail or prison, some of you are probably like, "I've been to prison, this jail stuff is nothing." But you know, people, my home group would write me, letters are such a big deal. And I got so much love from the people in my home group, you know, just sending me stuff that it made it, you know, I could saw the magic, you know, that is created here. So when I went back home, I went back to school. I finished out some probations, and I did a couple years of school in the Panhandle and worked. And then I went over to FSU, and finished my degree, and I ended up getting a degree in what's called actuarial science. It's like this heavy math degree. I got a really hard degree because I said, well, like, with my record, I need something that's in high demand, you know, so that maybe they'll look past it. And there's been a lot of fear going through stuff like that because, you know, for me, I'm less than. You know, I'm. If they knew who I was and what I did, they're not going to hire me. They're not going to be friends with me. They're not going to want to be my coworker. But talking, you know, working with the people in this program, AA has taught me how to grow up and how to get a job and how to do it correctly and how to face things without lying. I didn't know if I would ever have a driver's license back, and I have a driver's license today. I had the blow thing in my car for years. You know, just all these things. I have all my fines paid off today, and I mean, it took time. And I met my husband, spoke before me. I met him in the rooms, and you know, we have a beautiful life today. And I remember, I'm trying to make sure I'm not going to. I remember at one point in the rooms when people would talk and tell about their life and their story, and they'd be like, how bad it got, but they never got arrested. By the grace of God, they never got arrested or they never had a DUI, and I would get so annoyed. I'm like, it's not fair. Like, you know, my life is never gonna be good because I have this record. I'm never gonna be able to do anything with myself. And then it was all this, you know, I'm different because of that. And then one, you know, as I stayed sober, my husband and I had our first child. We have an 8-year-old and a 2-year-old. And, you know, a few, maybe a year or two after our 8-year-old was born, I was at a meeting and this woman was talking about losing her child, you know, to this disease. And I was thinking, you know, it is fair, you know, or whatever you want to say. It is their story. This is my story. And by God's grace, I'm walking around today, even if it is with somewhat of a record, but I came to the realization, my children never have to see me drink today. I mean, I've met and worked with women who have lost their children over this disease, and some have gotten back and some haven't. And by the grace of God, you know, if I keep doing this, you know, my two little girls never have to see this. You know, and today I work with others because, I don't know if one day either of our daughters will need this program, but I want it to be here, you know? I think, and I don't think I'm the only one who gets this, but I think there's this thing in sobriety when, like, 6 to 8 years sober, not sure if this is a known fact or not, but what I've seen or what happened to me is that you kind of lose it a little bit. And I did, there was a point in my sobriety where I kind of, you know, I was in Miami, so I go to school, I get this really good job, and by God's grace, he made it all work out that I was able to have this job. Like, they messed up and didn't pull my record until it was too late, and I was already there, so they were like, they talked to their lawyers and let me keep the job, basically. So, and I've been with this company almost 8 years now. So, but at the time, you know, it was just one of those things that God made work out, but I got real busy in Miami, and AA took a back seat. And I got really, really crazy, and I was really angry, and it was really hard for me to see that it was the connection of not hitting enough meetings. And by the grace of God, I didn't pick up, but I learned a lot from that experience. So today, I stay really involved, and sometimes I wonder how I get real busy, and I'm like, okay, you know, there was a point where I wasn't sponsoring in that time, you know, because I had too much going on, you know. To give away what was so freely given to myself. But you know, today I don't say no to sponsorship and I don't say no to service. And there was a point where it was getting, you know, I was getting real busy and somebody asked me and I was like, I don't think I can do all this and you know, and work and kids and this. And I talked to my sponsor and I talked to other women in the program who have a lot of time and they're like, God has a way of sorting this out. And that's one of the things that I have to remember today. I am not in control. And you know, handing my will, my life over to God means everything. So if I'm trying to do God's will on a daily basis, then I have to trust that God, you know, God, our book says, is everything or nothing. I believe God is everything today. My God, my higher power, whatever you want to call him. So if my God is everything, my God can handle that too. My God can handle busy days and sponsees that won't listen to me. That's okay. Or a sponsor who I don't like is what she's saying to me, who's calling me on my crap that day, you know. Or if I have a dispute at work or, you know, my God's got all of that. You know, if too many bills come up or God forbid my husband not doing what I want him to do, you know? But, you know, when I'm trying to do God's will and I let all that go, I get this total peace when I realize I'm really not in control. And that has to mean I'm not in control of anything today. And that's been a real that's taken me a long time to understand. But when I relinquish control of everything, I can walk around and reap the rewards of this program. The whole connection thing, I connect with people today. I go to my home group and I am excited to see the people in my home group. If we have a woman walk in that none of us recognize and we know she's new and she doesn't know that we notice, you know, we're all just like, oh, who's that, you know? I mean, we're just so excited to help somebody. I got a call a few days ago about somebody who had called the hotline, and it was just by a chain of events that I got the text, and I was able to go over there and take this woman to a meeting. And I remember the next day, I mean, I was just ecstatic. I mean, I went to work, nothing bothered me, and it's directly a connection to doing service work in this program. And the woman said to me, too, at one point, she's like, you're being so nice, you don't have to do this, I can't believe you're whatever. And I'm like, oh no, you don't understand. This is what we do to stay sober. And that's not like a joke. It's not a lie. It's not something we just say to make people feel better. Working with others is where it's at. And there was times, like I said, 6, 7, 8 years sober, I wasn't sponsoring. Nobody wanted what I had, you know? And today, it's a lot of work on 6 and 7. It's a lot of work on my character defects, but the longer I stay sober and connect with my higher power and connect with this program, I get to learn my ego blocks me from God. You know, my ego, if it's good or bad, if I'm the best or the worst in the room, that's what's blocking me. It's blocking me from connecting with you all, and it's blocking me from connecting with my higher power. But the fact today that no matter what happens, you know, in the worst of times and the best of times, I don't think about drinking, and that I can be happy and peaceful. You know, because my natural state isn't happy and peaceful. I wake up with my mind racing and I hit my knees. Most of the time, depending on how late, but you know, I hit my knees and I'm able to quiet that and give it over to God. And sometimes I have to do that several times a day. But I feel really blessed to have made it here. You know, it wasn't fair that I made it here. You know, I should have been dead. But it's been pointed out to me, no, you should be right here because this is exactly where God put you today. And I'm real grateful that you all sat and listened to me go on and on tonight, and thanks a lot for letting me share.